Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Good morning, Dan Perkins here, and I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to help small business leaders increase their profits. We draw our name from the best-selling book, which features contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business. Don?
Now, there's an old adage, grow or die, and no one knows it better than a small business leader. And one of the best people I've come across to help small businesses grow is Robert Glaser. He's founder and managing director of Acceleration Partners. And I'll leave the rest of the introduction up to you, Dan.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Robert. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
We have an interesting title for you. I've heard it many times. But we say you're a serial entrepreneur and an online customer acquisition specialist with an exceptional track record and passion for growing revenue and profits. You serve as an advisor to many growth-oriented companies in your practice. Start off, Robert, by just telling us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about your company. By the way, what is your company website?
Our company website is accelerationpartners, all one word, .com.
Okay. We'll put that on our website, recalculating.biz, along with your interview. So go ahead. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I'm the founder and managing director of Acceleration Partners and also the founder and chairman of a company called BrandCycle. I've been working with fast-growing businesses for almost 20 years now, both as an operator, an investor, and an agency, also as an advisor. So very focused on growth and, again, customer acquisition. One of my beliefs is that, you know, really what differentiates a fast-growing consumer business is not – you have to have a great product or service, but then it's about can you get customers to your business in a profitable way, and at the end of the day, that sort of determines success or failure for a lot of businesses.
Are you, if I might ask, Robert, do you consider yourself a B to consumer or B to business company?
You know, we do both. We are a B2B, but we have experience in customer acquisition from the B2B side, but we mostly work with large consumer brands who are seeking to attract customers to their business and online.
You've used a couple of times the word fast-growing business. Can you give us a sense of what growth rates might be for you to call it a fast-moving business? And are you specializing in a certain segment of the market?
Yeah, so we tend to specialize in consumer services and products. We are often working with the online division of the company. So if that's like a Target or an Adidas or Gymboree, their web business may be growing 40 or 50% a year, even if the total business isn't growing that fast. But I would say to me, fast growing is sort of above 15-20% a year is what we would consider pretty fast growing. I think you get down below 10 and that's sort of growing, but probably not fast growing.
Yeah. My old high school math says if you grow a business 15% a year, in 5 years you'll double the size of the business.
The rule is 72.
Yeah, it works, doesn't it? It always seems to work. You know, I'm interested in your perspective because we see what's happening in what we call the classic big box mall retailers closing right and left. Sears and Penney's may not survive. Macy's cutting 100 stores. Abercrombie and Finch is closing stores. Are we at a point, Robert, where the quote, the big box retailers, the shopping centers, whether they be strips or great malls, are a dying breed?
I don't know that they're dying. I think a lot of times people are confusing poorly run businesses with, you know, the overall market. I think there's certainly a large growth in e-commerce, but I think a lot of what you're seeing in retail and big box retail is just a lack of innovation and a lack of value that is putting them at a disadvantage with newer business models. But I've also read an equal amount of articles saying that there's a close association between the performance, you know, this omni-channel commerce of the physical store and the online, and that it goes hand in hand. Again, I look at a business like Sears, and they've just had no focus over the years. And I think you could, you know, what would take 20 years to sort of unravel in the past, it's just a faster cycle, and you're seeing that come to roost. I have not understood Sears' business strategy for years. They're just in too many types of businesses, and they're known for tools and all kinds of other stuff. So, I think it's dangerous to make generalizations. I think you have to provide a good customer experience. You have to provide value. You probably don't need as much square footage in the past, but I certainly don't think that means that, you know, any all traditional retail is dying. It just needs to adjust.
So when you think about, and I'm not picking on Sears, I'm just looking at what's happening in the retail space. I had a conversation with a very prominent real estate developer in New Jersey, many, many hundreds of apartments and strip shopping centers and big malls. And what he's telling me is that the small strip shopping centers, that it's more profitable for his company to tear them down and build senior housing than to continue to try and find tenants who continually walk away. So there seems to be some kind of a shift away from the big stores, but even some of the small strip malls are having trouble attracting traffic. And as the millennials get older, do you see them less inclined to go to malls, or is there going to be a paradigm shift and all of a sudden they're going to discover them, or are they going to be serious online shoppers?
It's going to be both. I'll tell you, the places that are really busy near me are these lifestyle plazas. So where you have, it's outdoors, you have mixed use, you have restaurants, you have stores. It's a place you'd want to be around. I just think the large indoor mall is not as attractive as it once was. But these outdoor plazas and lifestyle plazas seem to be mobbed. So, you know, it's a place that people want to go and be social and mix shopping with entertainment. I think there's certainly going to be changes to the mall. But it's really about value, right? You have to buy at value. When you talk about big box are shifting away. I mean, Amazon provides a lot of value. They spend all day thinking about how to get stuff to you easier, cheaper, faster. And I think
right.
One of the problems with the department stores is what's unique. You know, they're even building their stores as a collection of other brands right now. So you have to search each brand separately at different stores. I mean, at some point, that almost just becomes, you know, renting space to a small store. So I think people, you know, are just struggling to find value or unique proposition. And if you can get things cheaper and faster and better, you know, Amazon's winning a lot of that.
Do you subscribe to the theory that the millennials are moving to a more urban setting, but not necessarily living in the cities? They're living in larger suburbs near transportation where they don't need a car. They can walk to these malls, and they can walk to a grocery store. They've got movie theaters if they want to do that, but that seems to be also a dying industry. So are these lifestyle malls more tailored towards the millennials, do you think?
I think it's a little bit of both. Again, if you can get somewhere quickly or there's mixed use or there's housing nearby or it's a place where you would go pick up your breakfast and a drink and you drop by the store, there's probably just less shopping as a destination. You know, an example, my heart rate monitor needed a new battery yesterday, and I just looked up the battery on the back. There was one battery for the strap, another battery for the thing, and I went on Amazon, I ordered them, and they'll be here tomorrow. I mean, that's a 30-minute trip to CVS that I don't really need in my life.
Right.
So,
so
sort of use case specific.
So tell us about what it is you do for your potential customers.
Sure. So Acceleration Partners is the leading independent performance marketing firm in the U.S. We help clients to launch and manage what's called affiliate programs for pretty fast-growing brands, such as large ones you've heard of, such as Target, Adidas, Gymboree, Pier 1, Reebok. And last year, our clients' affiliate programs generated almost $1 billion in online revenue for them. So I know the next question might be, what's an affiliate program? So
You got it.
At 10,000 feet, you know, affiliate marketing is really when a company and a marketing partner, which is often called an affiliate or a publisher, they enter into a commission-based relationship that is pay for performance, cost per action, it's called, or I like to use COD, cash on delivery. So almost every online business over $1 million has an affiliate program. And in some ways, it's a framework of a way to pay partners more than a channel itself. Affiliates represent all kinds of different online marketing activities. They may have email lists. They could be public companies. They could be coupon sites, mommy bloggers, or sort of apps. So it's really working with marketing partners on a commission-oriented basis to get the outcomes that you're looking for.
Can you give us an example of this partnership of companies that work together and what each brings to the transaction?
Sure. I'll give you two different examples just to show the components. So let's take a retailer like Target. So they have an affiliate program. They work with a lot of maybe mom or lifestyle fashion bloggers, and they are part of the Target affiliate program, and they would link to Target through the affiliate program. And when there is a sale, they would get paid a commission. So they sort of spend the marketing and use their site and their merchandising, and they're paid only on a performance basis, and there's some tracking systems that measure this. And with an affiliate program, you can have thousands and thousands of partners like this because it's all set up in an automated system where the technology exists. You might have on sort of the lead side, let's imagine you have a really sophisticated home improvement company. You know, they might agree to pay $5 per qualified lead for someone who fills out an inquiry form on their site, and they could work with a lot of home improvement blogs or town directory or other things in their area where people are looking for these things, and they would market and advertise, and in that case they would get paid a lead fee because the sale would happen offline. The company would get sort of an inquiry form. So that's pretty common in insurance, lead generation, banking, things where you can't just buy it online, but a qualified customer can submit their interest online.
So,
Robert,
go ahead.
Dan, can I jump in a minute and ask a question? You're talking about a lead generation, which is pretty simple. If they put it in there, if they put their name in, you know that. But what happens on the buy side? When someone comes to a Target, looks,
yeah,
then comes back, comes out, and then goes back in, how do you track that person so that you know that
yeah,
they were
going? You work with what's called an affiliate network or a tracking platform. So each program picks a tracking platform. And what happens is when affiliates use a link, it is a special link that puts a cookie on the user's PC, and when they go to buy something, it checks for that cookie, which basically indicates that partner generated the sale and is due a commission. So each program has some sort of tracking component or partner, and that's why they're able to do this at scale. If you have 3,000 or 4,000 people join, and the tracking is automated, if they don't do anything that month, it doesn't cost you anything. And if they have a lot of sales, it's all set up to track and pay. You know, if this was done like as a business development program or one-off, it would be, you know, almost impossible to deal with this many people and people saying, hey, did I get a sale? Did I not get a sale? So the partner sees usually in real time or that same day, you know, what their clicks and sales and performance look like.
So you could have, in the case of your example of Target, you could have thousands of these, for lack of a better word, bloggers who are trying to drive traffic to Target?
Yeah, we manage programs that have more than 10,000 publishers. And now, you know, and Amazon's program, Amazon Associates, which is probably the largest in the world, I assume has hundreds of thousands, if not into the millions. So the benefit of these programs is they work at scale. And it's really, you know, the publisher, the affiliate gets to decide when they want to promote, how they want to promote. There's no minimums. Because it's all tracked and automated, there's really not a cost to adding more people or a cost to them sort of being inactive. So it's very partnership-driven and performance-driven.
So if somebody, if we had a listener out there who's thinking about what can I do to start my own small business, what kind of money can a person make in an affiliate program like you're talking about?
It really depends. So whenever people can use affiliate programs to grow their business, instead of a lot of one-off business development deals, they could use them to track it and get more accurate performance. But one of the things about becoming a publisher or an affiliate is there are people that are really smart. Like if you're a search engine optimization expert and you see an opportunity in the market to go build a site and rank for a certain topic and then convert to high-paying offers, you got to be a real marketing expert to do that. Most people do really well by writing about something that that they just know and love and have a natural audience about. So even if that was tractors and fixing old tractors, you know, and they got a lot of, and then they ranked highly on all things tractors, and then they linked to, you know, tractor repair companies' parts. You know, there are publishers who make, you know, tens of dollars a month, and then there are public companies that are publishers that make hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, or maybe even millions of dollars a month. So it really runs the entire range. And again, the more traffic and awareness you have as a publisher, the more monetization opportunities you're going to have.
What would be an example of a public publisher?
A coupon site such as Retail Me Not, or a loyalty cashback site such as Ebates. Actually Ebates was acquired, it's part of Rocketon, so it's not public, but those would be examples of large multi-billion dollar company.
So when we look at when we see a television commercial for prescription RS where they shop around to find the best prices on your prescription and they print out a coupon that you take and present to the pharmacy to buy your drugs, is that a example of what we're talking about?
Yeah, it can be. A lot of times when people are telling you to go to a specific landing page or use a specific code, and again, it starts to really, and my book, Performance Partnerships, is about this. It starts to all morph together, you know, just to a performance-based relationship. So if they have a landing page, Tim Ferriss, a lot of people know Tim Ferriss, he has his blog. Every time he talks about a product, he gives a very specific landing page to go to, product.com/Tim Ferriss. So that's usually to engage tracking. And that tracking then, you know, they know how many leads came from Tim Ferriss, and I'm pretty sure, you know, he has an agreement with that company that as part of the advertising, there is a performance component. Same thing if you're getting asked to download a coupon or turn it in, it's got a specific code. Anything that is specifically identifiable, oftentimes that's because someone's going to pull that together on the back end and run a report. So, you know, where affiliate marketing and business development or partner marketing, they overlap all under this. It's called more affiliate when it's, I think, totally tracked online and tracked electronically. But it's really the same principles that apply all over this. The difference between affiliate and referral is affiliate is sort of one-to-many, and I think referral is one-to-one. It's really more meant for, like, I'm going to give you an introduction to my gym. You'll get a month free. I'll get a month free. That's a different relationship than I would want than if I owned a massive fitness website. I don't want free months. I want cash for, you know, generating new members. So I could either do that with tracking or a unique code or otherwise. The problem with codes and using coupons to track is they can leak all over the internet, and you can end up paying a lot of money based on that code being used by not the people it was originally given to.
Mm. Is there a particular business out there that you think is a great candidate but is underutilizing what you're talking about?
So I think any business that's doing a million or two online and doesn't have an affiliate program should really think about setting one up. Again, if you're paying marketing partners at that point, or you're paying for other online marketing channels on just a pure payment basis, you know, you could start to set up relationships that are more on a performance basis. And I just think this is where it's going. There's so much advertising and marketing and touch points out there, but we're still paying for inputs and not paying for outcomes. I think it's better to arrange these win-win relationships and say, look, when I get a customer or I get a revenue or I get sort of get the output that I'm looking for, you know, then you get paid. And if I can track that in real time, even better. So you can see how you're doing. I can track it in real time, and we can, you know, we can work together on this kind of COD or cash on delivery basis.
Do you ever find that companies are their own partners?
In what sense?
Well, that they're out recruiting themselves for people to be partners.
Yeah, they're usually on one side or the other. You can be on both too. You can be a company who is who's basically looking to monetize. So they're recruiting partners to be marketing partners, and then they're recruiting partners to be retail partners because they have traffic that can be monetized. So I think that is it's common to be on both sides. It's called being both a merchant and an affiliate.
What do you do for your prospective clients? What services do you provide?
So we audit program. We'll come in if they don't have a program. We will help them set it up, figure out the tracking platform, the terms and conditions, and all that stuff. And then we will launch that program for them and help manage on an ongoing basis, which involves recruiting new people, developing campaigns. Again, once you have this network of people, you need to keep them engaged on ideas for your business and stuff that you know, will get them going and talking about the product. And we're always recruiting. That's really the lifeblood of any program, is getting new people into the program. So if you have an existing program, sometimes we'll come in, audit it, clean it up, and see if there are ongoing, you know, any issues or challenges that need to be fixed.
Don?
I was going to ask about your book, Robert. Well, what made you decide to write the book, and what's it about?
So the book's called Performance Partnerships, and it's on it's the checkered past, shifting present, and exciting future of affiliate marketing. So it gives a little bit of historical, how affiliate marketing was formed, some of the stuff that went on in Gen 1, which I call the Wild West, in which you had a lot of really smart marketing entrepreneurs who figured out how to do things faster than companies and took advantage of them a little bit, and sort of how it shifted. But you know, with the book talk, a lot, affiliate marketing is very misunderstood. It's a generally used term that covers a wide range of things. And so what it's meant to talk about is the future. I just think that more companies are going to move towards performance-based marketing relationships. One of the things the book talks about is marketplaces of marketing, which is, so if you think about an Uber or an Airbnb, you know, they've grown really fast because they didn't buy lots of hotels and cars. You know, same thing with eBay. They created a marketplace, and if you follow the rules and you obey the instructions, you can operate within that marketing place. Well, if I'm a fast-growing company, I can develop one of these programs, and I can open the marketing of my program up and have partners who are really smart partners. Maybe they know how to do SEO better than I do, or paid search, and they want to do that on a performance basis. They understand Snapchat. It's a little bit like these logo tournament websites where you open it up to, like, the crowd. I actually think that companies are going to start opening up their marketing to the crowd and create these systems where people who are really smart at one aspect of marketing can come in and do that for their business on a performance basis. And we're seeing some of the biggest companies in the world do this, and I think it's starting to, you know, trend down towards midsize and smaller companies as well.
Robert, we just got about a minute to go. Go ahead, Don.
I'm going to tell you an interesting thing that happened. I have a Platinum American Express card, and I got an offer from American Express for Uber. And it said that if I used the Platinum card with Uber, they would give me $15 off the first usage and $20 a month. Is that would that be affiliate marketing and performance marketing?
Yeah, so that's performance marketing, and that would be my definition of performance partnerships. Again, where the business development and affiliate marketing, it all merges, right? So that is a business development-like relationship that is probably tracked and measured. Whether it's paid out in real time or not, I don't know. But, yeah, that has more of the BizNev element to it because it's pretty standardized. But you can imagine if Uber just said, hey, we'll pay anyone X amount for the first ride, and then lots of different partners were able to market that would be more of a sort of traditional affiliate offer. But this is all converging where again, I think we have the ability to track and measure and pay for things only when they work, and I just think more companies are going to want to do that rather than maybe that relationship was 10 years ago and someone was going to do well and someone wasn't going to do well, right? They picked a rate. These days, they probably can look at the exact number of redemptions and, you know, adjust the payout accordingly.
Well, Dan,
I just have one
quick
question. If you've talked about all the people who can win, who's the loser in this deal?
Who's the loser? So the loser are overpriced service providers who, you know, ran that billboard for you that no one saw and got paid a lot of money. The agency told you they were a huge expert in this and you paid them $5,000 or $10,000 and, you know, they got you no results. So I think anyone's service or offering that is not tied to results would be the loser in more of a performance economy.
Yeah. Well, Robert, thank you for your insights and your time today. And give us your website one more time.
Sure. Well, the website's accelerationpartners.com, but if you go to performance-partnerships.com to the book site, you can download a free chapter. And if you have an affiliate program, there's a 5-minute test right there that'll score it and grade it for you called Affiliate Grader, which can be really helpful to see if you have opportunities for improvement.
Well, thank you, Robert, for joining us today, and we'll be right back with a word from our sponsor.
Thanks, Dan and Don.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's secure file transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Well, since we've got an exceptional guest here, maybe the conversation between Jim and I will give some money in motion. Our next guest is James H. Lee, a long and successful track record in investment management and research. He is a certified financial planner, a chartered financial analyst, and a chartered market technician. He's got a lot of initials after his name. James has gained media attention as Delaware's only professional futurist. Jim Lee has been quoted in publications of the Wall Street Journal, Financial Planning, Medical Economics, and he's written for AARP, the Journal of Future Studies, Technical Forecasting, and Social Change. Welcome, if you would, James Lee. How are you, sir?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me today.
Well, as we have, we want to know a little bit about you and then what you do with your company, and then we'll take it from there. So tell us about who you are.
Sure. Well, I am a financial futurist, and what I do is I work with individuals who are either preparing for or in retirement, and I work with them to build portfolios that are reflective of who they are. So I do that in three ways. The first is to look at the big picture as a professional futurist to see what the big trends are over the course of the next decade or two. Next, after that, I'm also a chartered financial analyst. So once we look at those trends, we can identify the companies that are best positioned to benefit from those trends. And then the third level that I bring to the table is as a market technician to really fine-tune my entry points and my exit points. And I do this really primarily for individual clients.
So what is your I'm going to get this out of the way real quick. Your website?
It's www.stratfi.com, S-T-R-A-T-F-I. It stands for Strategic Foresight Investments.
So you call yourself a futurist.
Yes.
Tell us about what a futurist does.
Sure. Well, the strategic foresight is the process of using what we understand about the future to make better decisions today. And as an academic field, it's been around for about 40 years or so, really ever since the 1970s. There's actually a university program here in the U.S. that is dedicated to turning out futurists at a graduate level. That's at the University of Houston. I'm a graduate. It's a wonderful program. They put out about 12 to 20 futurists per year. And they go into all sorts of different industries, helping people to build better tomorrows.
So I, as you heard, I think on the introduction of the show, I've been in the money business for 43 years, and I have a boutique practice of individuals and entrepreneurs, small business people who don't have time to manage their money, and they'd like their money to work as hard as they do. And that's sometimes hard to do because some of my clients work really hard and really long hours. Let's talk a little bit about, as a futurist, let's talk about some issues that might be important to our small business people. First and foremost, let's talk about what you think about the economy and the opportunity for small business going forward.
Sure. You know, one of the themes that I've been working around is really sort of what I refer to as the zombie recovery. And that is, over the course of the last 10 years or so, overall GDP growth being roughly half of what it used to be. And we were in this situation for a long time where the economy wasn't dead, it wasn't alive, it was just kind of shambling mindlessly for a few years. Now, the good news is I'm beginning to see a pickup in economic growth over the course of the last few years. So I might have to put that trend off the table, you know, coming soon.
Do you think it's possible that your belief about the future of the economy would have been different had somebody else won the presidency other than Mr. Trump?
You know, it's possible. And if you look at my client base, some were rooting for Trump, some were rooting against Trump. I would say the biggest thing that he's contributed to the discussion at this point is the idea of cutting corporate tax rates and repatriating overseas profits, which really could be a big boom for the economy. And I think that it kind of lit a fire into the market, too. You know, we've had a nice rally running from November to right about last month. It's cooling off just a little bit, but it's been a nice run while it's lasted.
Right. Do you think that there are some people who feel that the repatriated money will first go to shareholders in terms of either buybacks or increase in dividends before they invest in plant and equipment? Now, some people, depending upon who you talk to, say that that number could be anywhere from $2 to $3 trillion. Do you think that's a likely scenario? What's going to happen if we get a repatriation attractive tax rate?
I think it would be actually one of the better cased scenarios if, again, those overseas earnings get repatriated and then distributed to shareholders, perhaps in terms of a one-time dividend or ongoing payments, for example, through shareholder repurchases. And part of that is just because when you look at retirees and you look at people that live off of their portfolios, interest rates are just so low right now. It's hard to earn income off of a bank account or off of your treasury bonds or even off of some of your blue chips. So if we can bring back some of that money to help people live a little bit more comfortably, yeah, raise a little bit more tax money, and meanwhile increase spending domestically, I think that that would all be a very good thing.
There's some people that, you know, I've been talking about this for a long time, that for many, many years, a typical near retiree or retiree's portfolio would have a certain percentage in a money market account, a certain percentage in CDs. The rest would be invested in stocks and bonds and mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
When we had the crisis in 2008, the money market and CD side practically went to zero. In fact, money markets did go to zero. Short-term treasuries were close to zero.
Slightly negative, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And so that component that was being used to provide supplemental income beyond Social Security and their regular portfolio
Gone. Disappeared.
It disappeared.
Yeah.
And it disappeared mm-hmm. for a long period of time. Even today, we've got the yield on the 10-year treasury about 2.3%, which is not, I mean, it's not even as good as the current, well, a little bit better than the current yield on the S&P 500, but it's almost a push. I mean,
barely keeping with inflation, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Yes. And so as we look further going down the road, what is your thought about economic growth?
You know, I think it's going to be slower, and there are a few reasons behind that. One really has to do with demographics, aging demographics in particular. Another one has to do with a long-term social cycle that I've identified and I've been working with for a while now. Now, the counter argument to that, of course, has to do with productivity, automation, and artificial intelligence, which I think you're really going to see that kick in the 2020s. So we're getting to a point where we could see higher growth and, in particular, higher productivity. We're not quite there yet.
Don, my partner, is on the National Robotics Board, and he and I have had a lot of discussions about the implication of robotics replacing human beings working in many parts of our economy. Does that mm-hmm. cause you any concern?
Yeah, I do a lot of work talking about the future of work, automation, and in particular the need for personal reinvention. And we really had the first round of automation happen here in the U.S. about 100 years ago with the uptick in factories and machining, basically. You go back to 1900, and half the U.S. population was involved in farming in some way, shape, or form. I mean, my grandparents were farmers. My wife's grandparents were farmers. You might have some in your family, too.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that industry didn't go away, but it is now just 3% of the total population by employment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to see displacement on that. You know, next time around, it had to do with factory workers dealing with automation of car lines. And now the automation that you're seeing really has to do with automation of cognitive work, right? And that would involve things like travel agents, real estate agents, financial advisors, even journalists to a certain degree. I mean, I wake up and every day, I probably read at least one article that was written by a computer.
Concerning what?
Oh, that's frightening. As a newsman, that's a frightening thought.
Yeah, it is. It's primarily right now in sports writing and financial writing at this point. But again, you're going to see a lot more encroachment in sort of the traditional cognitive work in terms of thinking and communicating. More and more of that is going to be done by computers, you know, to the extent that over the course of the next two decades, you're probably going to have a 20% shift in employment, largely based on the fact that a lot of these service-oriented jobs are going to be automated. And you're already seeing that in retail right now with main streets and malls just getting emptied out due to Amazon and online shopping platforms.
Go ahead.
I was going to even in your own field as financial advisors, both you and Dan, that they're talking about having artificial intelligence answering questions from consumers about their stocks, et cetera. Do you think that's as eminent as some people think it is?
You know, it's already happening, and it's happening at the tail end, and that is the robo-advisors, as they're referred to, are focused primarily on small accounts for young customers, basically your millennials. But they're picking up more assets, they're picking up more steam. And they basically pick the low-hanging fruit of the advisory business. Simple accounts without complicated questions, building portfolios based around index strategies. That's pretty easy stuff to do. Now, what's interesting is if you look at some of these platforms, they're actually using sort of a back office based on 1970s portfolio theory, sometimes called MPT or modern portfolio theory. Mm-hmm. So while the front ends are really glossy and attractive, the back end in many cases is really kind of old-fashioned. What I find interesting about what the robo-advisors are bringing to the table is this idea of automating the client onboarding process, and that they've gamified the system so that it literally is fun and engaging for you to give them your money, right? And I think that's very interesting, and I think traditional advisors might be able to learn something from that.
So is it the front end, the shiny object that is attracting the millennials, and they don't do their homework to understand what it is they're doing? So is it that shiny object of super neat technology, it's robo, you don't need a human being, all those things we're talking about? Is that what attracts the millennials to that?
Yep.
To that?
Bright, shiny dashboards with lots of user incentives. You know, mm-hmm. progress bars, for example, you're 5% there, you're 20% there, you're 50% there, you're almost there. Lots of colors, lots of audible feedback. They make it very easy and very automated. That being said, I haven't seen the depth of advice there yet to suggest that it is appropriate for more affluent or more complicated investors.
I wonder about the I know that the robo stuff has been around a while, but not terribly long. What does the futurist in you tell you about the ability of robots to deal with cataclysmic events like we had in 2008?
It kind of depends on how you deal with it. I mean, robots have not done well traditionally with volatility. You may recall a strategy a few years ago called portfolio insurance,
mm-hmm.
where a downtick in the market would trigger sales to position clients into cash. And what that did is it created a feedback loop where sales would trigger more sales, and then 15 minutes later, you'd be off, you know, 30% on an index fund.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had one of those flash crashes happen just 2 years ago, and I was picking
right.
up index funds at, you know, 60 cents on the dollar. It was really kind of crazy, and it lasted about 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, you know, in all the years that I've been in this business, I try to tell people that investing is more art than science, because when you have experience, as you and I both have, of being around through market crashes and bull markets and huge bear markets, you begin to understand different sets of dynamics than somebody who just starts out in the business, or for that matter, even a robot. And I think that there are times when the volatility, as you point out in the market, the robots need some kind of a trigger in order for them to buy. And I remember in 2008, it was obvious to me that the opportunity in 2008 was in the preferred stock area, because as dangerous as things were, the government figured out that the best thing to own in all the companies that they were going to put money in was preferred stocks. And you could buy the preferred stocks of the banks at 11, 12, 13% yields. And eventually,
it's like
they
the early 80s. Yeah.
Huh?
It was like the early 80s again, right?
Yeah. I mean, so that there are patterns there, but it takes courage to go in when the market's falling like a rock, to go in and take a stand and say, I'm going to buy this because I think this longer term, this has particular value. I'm not sure that the robots can do that yet.
Yeah, it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to do that, a lot of courage. You know, when I look at the discipline of investing, I think it's a combination of an art and a science. But more specifically, if you think of it, it's a liberal art to the extent that it involves an understanding of history and psychology and systems and accounting and just all of these things put together. It's really something that I love to do, and hopefully I'm able to communicate that to my clients as well.
Yeah, I'm a big believer and have been for a long, long time in both fundamental and technical analysis. Markets do have trends. Stocks do have cycles that they trade in. And if you pay attention to the charts, you can see when a stock is bottomed out or when a stock is going towards the top. And there are opportunities then to make some investments based on instincts, experience, and just what's going on. You say in your profile that you have some work in medical economics. I would love to hear your thoughts about the replacement for Obamacare, and with Obamacare, where are we heading in this country for medical care?
Wow, it's a tough nut to crack, and everyone's working on it right now. My wife is actually a physician at the local hospital, and she specializes in infectious disease medicine. And in a lot of ways, you're seeing doctors working harder. Margins are declining. You're actually seeing more women in medical school now than men. And you're also seeing a lot more foreign students coming into the U.S. as well. So there's a lot of work for people to do. But because so much business is tied in with Medicare and healthcare reimbursements, since those margins are declining, the economics are becoming, in many cases, less appealing. Now, what's really interesting is I learned recently that the most attractive branch of medicine to work in is dermatology. That's actually where the best and the brightest are going these days, because they can run 9-to-5 office hours. They generally don't have many skincare emergencies, and many of the patients pay for their services out of pocket.
So they're not dependent on Medicare. There's a do you see any? I hear about it. I live in Southwest Florida, in a retirement community. I'm not retired, but there are an awful lot of people who've come from all over the North and the Midwest who've retired here to Sanibel.
Sanibel, great.
Yes, I've often wondered about when it comes to medical care. Where do you think we're heading? Are we heading for a robotic model in medical care too?
You're definitely seeing a push towards that. Intuitive Surgical, for example, has robot-assisted surgeries where they're making incisions that are much smaller than surgeons can use freeform, you know, with their own hands. You're beginning to see technologies such as three-dimensional printing being used in dentistry, for example. You're also going to see a lot coming out from IBM in particular using their Watson system for artificially intelligence-guided diagnostics and tools as well. So there's definitely a push towards that. You know, again, automating the surgical process, automating the diagnostic process. Probably the thing that I find most interesting right now is the use of bioinformatics, specifically genetic sequencing, to determine what patient health risks are. Okay. So there's a company that I've been tracking for a while now called Invitae, which does genetic screening for patients. And on one hand, you have medical companies, pharmaceutical companies paying them to find patients that have certain genetic disorders for which they can treat. On the other hand, they also have the potential to receive income from the insurance companies to determine whether or not they should be paying for certain treatments. So I see that as one area that has potential to really ramp up over the course of the next few years.
One of the things that concerns me, Jim, is that the number of doctors leaving the profession over the last decade or so, where it's most painful, where it's most difficult, is in the rural communities where there are areas that have no medical specialties in certain areas. I did a lot of volunteer work in Preston County, West Virginia, and for the longest time, 10, 15 years, they didn't even have a gynecologist in the hospital. And yet we're also seeing in big cities hospitals closing as there's more and more price pressure on both the hospital itself and what it can charge and get reimbursed through Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, what the non-dermatologist doctors can make in their practices. And I wonder, are we seeing a contraction in the medical profession?
I think it's early just yet to make that statement, but it could certainly happen. And one sort of early trend that I'm seeing are hospitals like Kaiser Permanente running their own health insurance, saying you pay for insurance through us, and then we will be your single source service provider, right? Mm-hmm. And that way they have a little bit more control over the over the cost structure of what they do.
So the shift in demographics of more women coming into the, as you said, the medical profession, what are the men doing?
It's something else, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. Hopefully you'll tell me what they're doing.
Right. One of the other big shifts that I've been tracking over the last few years is really the growth in startup mentality. Internet startups, web startups. We saw a little bit of a blossoming of the legal profession a few years ago, right after the 2008-2009 crisis. The bloom sort of seems off that rose, at this particular point. But I don't have a good answer for you in terms of where the men going. One thing that is happening is a lot of them are, to a certain degree, getting more involved in the parenting process, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a continuation of two-income families. In a lot of cases, the woman is becoming the breadwinner. So there's a little bit of a role reversal that we're starting to see there.
And if the father stays at home, he might be running his own online small business to provide supplemental income, but at the same time be able to be with his children.
Absolutely. Yeah. I call it gender blending, right? Mm-hmm.
And the increase in foreigners coming in for medical school is that a function of the growth in Asia and the demand for healthcare and a short supply of colleges in those countries to produce the medical doctors that people are coming into the United States to get their training?
Well, it's a little bit of wage arbitrage because, relatively speaking, the wages in the U.S. are still quite good. And when you have immigrant families coming in, there's a strong willingness to work and pay your dues. And, you know, a lot of them are still viewing medicine as an appealing alternative.
Don, anything you want to jump in there on?
Well, there's a lot I want to step in, but I've been listening to two of you, and it's been really fascinating. I'd like to go in a totally different direction and ask a question. I'm a small business owner. I'm reaching the age of 65 to 70, and my children don't want to have anything to do with the business. What do I do?
Sure. So that goes in the category of succession planning. And it's really about helping your own retirement by figuring out what happens next to your business and being able to recapture some of the value that you've developed in your business over the last few years.
Well, what do you think of ESOPs?
Employee stock option plans. That's a little bit out of my bailiwick. I can't contribute meaningfully to that conversation. I apologize for that.
You're doing such a great job. No need to apologize. I just have a lot of questions, and I have one that just came across my desk, which I'll throw at you. You know, they talk about balance, and Dan always talks about balance in your portfolio. What's your idea of balance in your in a retiree's portfolio?
Sure. I think the definition is changing, and Dan and I can probably have a great conversation on this one, because we were both sort of raised in the days where, you know, a moderate retirement portfolio would be 60-40, you know, roughly 60% invested in equities and 40% in cash and bonds. And then we had this this thing that happened in 2008 and 2009 where diversification didn't fail. And all asset classes became very diversified or very correlated when you needed that diversification the most, okay? So here we are going on 10 years later, and bonds don't make a whole heck of a lot of sense anymore. You know, getting 3% after taxes, after inflation, you're still coming out net negative. What I've been doing in my own business is I've been focused on equities that generate exceptional dividends. And I've also been focused on tactical strategies that enable me to harvest reasonably stable returns with less volatility than the market. But you've got to get creative, because all the obvious choices have left, right? And smart money doesn't necessarily know where to go anymore.
Right. Jim, I tell people, having been in the business 40 years, that my generation, I don't know how old you are, Jim, but I'm 72. My generation has seen three attacks on their portfolio of 40% or more since the year 2000.
Big one,
and
yeah. Mm-hmm.
The dot-com bubble at the turn of the century, the real estate collapse, and then this huge decline in 2008 when we thought the world was going to come to an end. I don't know how a person's retirement account can virtually survive in that kind of a physical assault on, as you pointed out, all the alternatives were basically destroyed. There's got to be
right.
A lot of people out there who have seen significant degradation of their portfolios. And as a result, finding themselves insufficiently funded in retirement that they're going to have to continue to work.
Oh, retirement is being redefined even as we speak. And I think some of the conditions that you've talked about in terms of these, you know, three or four really big hits to the market are one of the reasons why we've seen a flight to more conservative, low volatility stocks, for example. It's part of the reason why we've seen an explosion within the indexed annuity business, mm-hmm. where you have insurance companies, in essence, giving you minimum guarantees in terms of future income through their annuity products.
Mm-hmm.
And people are definitely looking for alternatives right now.
Well, Jim, we have to go. Thank you for spending so much time with us. And we enjoyed the conversation. I hope our audience did. And we'll have to have you back. So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Really been fascinating, Jim.
Yeah, this is Dan Perkins. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.